Hi, everyone. I'm Stephen Fine. I direct the Center for Israel Studies at Yeshiva University. The history of the Jews in America has been one of the most fascinating chapters in modern Jewish writing. What Jews have thought, what they have lived, how they have Americanized. But one of the Are we all right in there? Should I continue without the mic? Have you got it? Are you okay? Okay, good. So we can start. Welcome. The history of the Jews in America and the history of American Jewry in the history of Zionism are both fascinating. Those who think about the place of American Jewry beginning even before the Balfour Declaration and continuing to the present in the making and development of Medinat Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael before. It's quite astonishing, but there are lots of holes. And one of the largest holes in the history of the Jews in the modern world in general, and in America in particular, is the place of orthodoxy in this amazing mosaic of transformation. The place of traditionalism, the place of traditional religion. When we went looking to find out what had been written about the history of religious Zionism from inside, it became very clear that the American role, which is so obvious in the history of all of cultural Zionism, has barely been written about. I remember one day when I opened up Rav Kasher's Torah Shlema, first volume, published in New York, and went down the list of all the donors, and I realized that it was everybody whose names are on the donor list of what was then Yeshiva College. That something was going on. That there's a relationship that's much deeper than the political, there's much deeper than the ways that we've been talking about this material. And so Professor Olson and I set about thinking about what we could do to begin to open up this conversation. Now, the first thing we began to do was look in our YU archives, and more to the point, and is always the case, speak to our elders. Because, in fact, our senior faculty all about the campuses are quite astonishing in their knowledge, in their participation, in what they've done, and nobody knows. And so this day came out of those conversations. Now, this is a day dedicated to two of our gedolim, to Rabbi Roth and to Rabbi Rosenzweig. Two people who have made our institution, who have made our community, who have made our congregations, who have taught their Talmidim and taught their students, and of course they're the same people. Now, the day that we've put together is really an astonishing project. After all, we have a Rosh Yeshiva, we have the Mashgiach Ruchani, we have the philosopher of world renown, and we have a professor, an assistant professor of Jewish history, who's about to become one of the Gedolim of YU, but he needs another 30 years to do it. Now, it's an amazing day. You know, I'm so sad because David Schatz really wanted to be with us today, and some of the YU websites say that he is, but he couldn't be for reasons of scheduling. But he so wanted to be with us, and of course David would have added so much to this event, and we're sorry he couldn't do it. Now, our program is as follows. We're going to begin with Rabbi Blau, who's going to speak first, followed by Rabbi Carmi, followed by Dr. Olson, followed by Rabbi Rosenzweig, followed by Rabbi Rosenzweig, followed by Rabbi Roth. At the end of our day, Rabbi Roth and Rabbi Rosenzweig are of course going to respond and say what they want to say and greet the community and celebrate with us. After all, the Center for Israel Studies, from its inception, has believed in the gedula of our faculty. And so we began our first project, the Temple of Jerusalem from Moses to the Messiah, honored one of our greatest of historians, Louis Feldman. In the fall, you're going to see in print a festschrift, Shoshanat Yaakov, in honor of Yaakov Ellman, and today, Rabbi Roth and Rabbi Rosenzweig. And so I'm very happy to invite to speak for 20 minutes, Rabbi Blau, please. Oh, you need the tape recorder.
It's an honor to participate, and certainly I've learned a great deal from both Rabbis Rosenzweig and Rabbi Roth. In fact, I'm already in trouble because I commented to Rabbi Rosenzweig, since a critical person in what I'm going to discuss is Rav Meir Berlin, later Bar Ilan, and he said, oh, I had a conversation with him, I can tell you about him directly. I didn't get a chance to ask Rabbi Roth if he ever had a conversation with him as well. In fact, the lack of a critical biography of Rabbi Bar Ilan is a real lack in the history of religious Zionism, not just in America, but in the world and in Israel. Rabbi Yaakov Reines started Mizrahi in Europe in 1902, as is well known. In America, within a year, small groups of chapters began. In fact, if you note on my talk, there seemed to be some question about what date Mizrahi started, and that's because there are a number of different candidates for that date. 1903, according to some, the semi-jubilee volume was put out in 1936, implying that it started in 1911. Officially, it started in 1913, and its founding convention was in 1940. So you pick which of those years you want, and there's reasons for all of them. Who were these people who started these small chapters of Mizrahi in different parts of the United States? Essentially, there were two groups. They came from two bases. One, there already were supporters of the Chovei Tzion movement in the United States, most of whom were Orthodox, and they naturally transferred over to Mizrahi. And there were European Rabbanim who had come to America to serve in the rabbinate, some of whom had direct contact with Rabbi Reines or Rabbi Mollover and came as Mizrahi people. For example, a name, obviously not well known anymore, Rabbi Dov Ber Abramowitz, who was the first official president in 1914 after the first convention, knew Rabbi Reines in Europe, and he became a rabbi in St. Louis. The next decade, these groups functioned sporadically. In fact, the entire Zionist movement in the United States sort of functioned sporadically. There was a competition, there were two groups, it's not my topic, but there was a split. One representing the quote-unquote uptown Jews, the old German Jewish community, and the other the immigrants. This played a role in Mizrahi in a dual way. On one hand, if everything is a mess, no one can really help you very much. On the other hand, the executive secretary of one of the groups, of the Federation of American Zionists, by the name of Jacob D. Haas, was able to give a little bit of money to Mizrahi on the goal and the hope that they would join him. They would come over on his side, even though, frankly, his side was the uptown side. That eventually became Brandeis. Certainly not that world. Now, what could these early Mizrahi people contribute? They certainly didn't have very much money. And they had just come to America from Eastern Europe. They weren't picking up on the next boat and going to Palestine. So they could give a modicum of moral support. That's really all they had, which is why it was hard to organize to anything, because you have nothing specific to focus on. In 1913, Rabbi Meir Berlin, now known as Bar Ilan, the younger son of the Netziv, is sent to America to organize a convention to make a Mizrahi in America. Rabbi Berlin is, in many respects, the most important figure for the time period that I'm describing. In fact, in 1926, when he leaves, it's a whole new era, when he goes to Palestine, to Israel. He comes to America. Where does he come from? He comes from Berlin. Coincidence. He comes from Berlin because that's where the world executive of Mizrahi is located. He brings with him tremendous organizational ability and about as much a religious yichus as one could possibly get. Right? With all his connections, for those of you who are familiar with either in Hebrew or in Yiddish, when from Volozhin, Bizirushalayim, and he talks about his relationships with his father, the Netziv, his grandfather, the Aruch HaShulchan, his nephew who brought him up, Reb Chaim Briska, his brother-in-law, Rafal Shapiro, covers quite an area. He comes to America, he organizes, and the convention is held in Cincinnati, which would be a surprising place. But apparently Mizrahi hadn't really made it in the New York area. And it was primarily in the Midwest. This Rabbi Abramowitz is made the president. Another name who comes to play at this point is Rabbi Zev Gold. Rabbi Wolf Gold, Rabbi Zev Gold. Rabbi Gold was born and trained in Europe. In fact, I don't think I'm going to mention any names through 1925 of anybody born in America. In fact, in a certain sense, Mizrahi is in America, but it's not American. Zev Gold is the closest we get because he was a Rav in major congregations in the United States. So he really had a sense of the American community. But in the end, he settles in Israel and Palestine. Of course, as does Rabbi Berlin, the Rabbi Gold comes back in the 30s after my time frame. Rabbi Gold writes about meeting Rabbi Berlin at the port, he with a few other people. He organizes Mizrahi, goes back to Europe, and it falls apart because there's nothing to keep it together. Then comes World War I. World War I changes everything. First of all, Rabbi Berlin and Yehuda Leib HaKohen, then Fishman, later Maimon, both end up in America. Not because they want to be in America. Rabbi Berlin was thrown out of Germany because he was a Russian citizen. He was from the enemy. Obviously it didn't make any sense for him to stay in Europe. Even in England there wasn't that much. He had already been once in America. He comes to America and stays there from 1915 to 1926 and becomes president. He runs Mizrahi. Rabbi Fishman was already in Palestine. He is thrown out of Palestine by the Turks for being a Zionist agitator. So he comes to New York as well. In many respects, those three names are the critical names. Rabbi Gold is the great orator. I even heard him speak once. Rabbi Berlin is the organizer and the one who knows everybody and has all the connections. Rabbi Fishman is the ideologue. In 1916, at the third convention, a debate takes place. Should Mizrahi focus solely on support of the new yeshuv, or should it divide its time between Palestine and America? And it votes to put its efforts in both, to split it between the American Orthodox community and the yeshuv in Palestine. I suspect Rabbi Fishman was on the minority side, but I don't have records. I wasn't able to get the records from that convention to know. Rabbi Berlin becomes a major player in Orthodoxy in the United States, both as head of Mizrahi and as a separate individual, founder of the Central Relief, one of the founders of Agudas Rabbanim, and very active in Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzhak Elchanan. And here comes something which I think hopefully you'll find interesting. In order to do things to build up Orthodoxy in America, Rabbi Berlin realizes that we have to work on education, which means you have to train teachers. So the Mizrahi in 1917 starts a teachers' institute for men. In the next couple of years, that teachers' institute becomes a partnership between Mizrahi and Yeshiva. In 1921, Dr. Revel, president of Yeshiva, goes on a leave of absence for half a year because he goes to Tulsa, Oklahoma to help with the family business. Who becomes acting president of Yeshiva? Rav Meir Berlin. What is his very first act? He transfers the Teachers Institute to Yeshiva. Now, I can't tell you exactly why he did it. I did have access to an interview with Dr. Pinchas Churgin, who headed the Teachers Institute in Yeshiva till he went to found Bar Ilan University in the 50s, well after the death of Rabbi Bar Ilan. And also looking at Rabbi Berlin's letters in the early 20s, the conclusion that I came up with was it was very much a question of money. What was going on? After the end of the First World War, the yeshuv starts to pick up people, the new yeshuv. People are leaving Eastern Europe, some leaving Germany, and they're coming. Economic resources are not going to be found in the devastated Europe. America wins the war, and while many Americans were killed like everyone else, but there were no bombs in the United States. It took place on foreign soil. America's in much better shape. The letters of Rav Berlin in the early 20s are all about raising money in America for the Tachkamoni in Yafo, for the Teachers Institute for Women in Israel. It's all about raising money for Israel. There's no way a Teachers Institute in America could function without someone supporting it from the outside. It's not going to pay its own way. So with the combination of money needs and a shift in focus more towards what's going on in then Palestine, now Israel, Rav Meir Berlin gives the Teachers Institute over to Yeshiva. Now, for the younger people in the room, may I point out, and I won't talk about it unless someone asks later, the Isaac Breuer College is after a number of Gilgulim, is the old Teachers Institute. Now, remember, the Teachers Institute in 1920 and 1925 was producing teachers. Right? It was meant to produce teachers. No one thought that someone had to be a rabbi to be a teacher in mainly in Hebrew schools or very few day schools. And truthfully, when I was a student in Yeshiva in the second half of the 50s, there was a TI, didn't have another name yet, It wasn't producing teachers anymore. I think there was one fellow, I recall, the 4 years of college that I was in that went there to become a teacher. And one fellow had me help him pass one of the gemers, as they called it, in their broken Hebrew English. You know, a gemer you had to take to get licensed as a teacher. And the students called them gemers in their mixed language. Anyway, there's a shift. The influence of Mizrahi is still felt in America in the following ways. Number one, the day schools get founded in the 20s. Most of them are Ivris be'Ivris. The Teachers Institute, of course, is in Hebrew. Even Tor Vadas, which was basically founded by Rabbi Gold, was in Yiddish. Right? This was a Mizrahi influence. While there's more to be said, there was a certain Chochmas Yisrael component in much of the Mizrahi people. Dr. Churgin was a major Mizrahi figure. He, together with Leon Gelman, put out in 36 the Semi-Jubilee volume. Interestingly, that in that Semi-Jubilee volume, you still have the debate about role in America, and Rabbi Yaakov Levinson, who was the first Gemara teacher in Teachers Institute, and the first person to teach Gemara in Hebrew in America, writes about the importance of maintaining involvement in American Orthodoxy. And he, using the slogan, which by the way comes from Rameir Bar Ilan, Eretz Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Pitaras Yisrael, he says, well, in America we get 2 out of 3. Right? So we don't have the Eretz Yisrael, but at least you have Am Yisrael, Pitaras Yisrael, and therefore it's important we continue to get involved. My time is practically up, so I'm just going to say 2 or 3 words about the founding of Mizrahi women and those things that I didn't mention and why not. Mizrahi, there are women's auxiliaries of Mizrahi from the very beginning, but what happened is women raised money and the men spent it. And at one point, one of the women said, we raise the money, we spend it. In 1925, Mizrahi Women is founded. A woman by the name of Adele Goldstein becomes the first president. But in a certain sense, more important, this Adele Goldstein has a stepdaughter whose name is Bessie Gottsfeld. And Bessie Gottsfeld really is the power behind Mizrahi Women. And she and her husband move to Israel, where she takes hand-on involvement in the projects, in the schools, in the homes, the Kfar Batches, the Beit Sirot LeMizrahi. Over the next numbers of decades, Mizrahi Women then becomes autonomous, but that's a story that starts in 1925. Why didn't I mention Apollo Mizrahi? Because Apollo Mizrahi, which had started in Eastern Europe in the early 20s, did not arrive to the American scene yet. It couldn't arrive in the American scene for a number of reasons. Number one, American Jews were not thinking about Aliyah at all. The first person that I know of, born in America, who makes Aliyah and lives on a kibbutz, graduate of Yeshiva College, a person of note that people have forgotten, his name is Eliezer Goldman, graduate of Yeshiva College in 1936, brilliant fellow, makes Aliyah, is a Jewish philosopher. By the way, Betsy Gottsfeld's nephew. Right? But all the names of people I'm talking about are Europeans. It's not American yet. It's not American. No Aliyah. Socialism doesn't sell as well in America as it does in Eastern Europe. And therefore, Apollo Mizrahi, which does play an important role, but much later. Similarly, you're not going to have your youth movements yet. You have a Tzeire Mizrahi, but not a Mizrahi at Tzeir. It's a big difference. Tzeire Mizrahi means that people were 30 instead of 60. Right? It's not a youth movement. Hashem Haradati, Bnei Akiva all start much later. And since I restricted myself to the early period, I can't talk about them. I'm basically finished my talk. And I say once again, the key figure who really deserves a dissertation, either in Israel or here, is Rav Meir Berlin Bar Ilan, who dominates not just America when he's here, but world Mizrahi. In fact, Rabbi Berlin, Rabbi Maimon, and Rabbi Gold are three of the world leaders of Mizrahi as long as they're alive. But that doesn't mean that they bring the influence of America, because they're not really Americans, even though they built Mizrahi in America. Thank you.
At the end of the four talks, we are going to have a panel of all the speakers to discuss with the community our day's events. Our next speaker is Rabbi Shalom Carmi of Yeshiva College. Rabbi Carmi.